Brian, early on in your legal career, you had an encounter with the police right after you moved into a new apartment in Atlanta. Can you tell me what happened?
Sure. I was a young attorney living in Atlanta, Georgia, and had actually just been pulled into a case involving police misconduct. I was representing or investigating a case where a young man in Alabama had been shot and killed by the police. He was stopped by a police officer for some traffic violation. He was a very young driver. And when the police came up to him, he was nervous. He kept his driver's license in the floor of the car. He reached down to get his driver's license. The police officer was alarmed by that, pulled his weapon, and when the young man saw the police officer with a gun, he jumped, and the police officer shot and killed him. There was evidence that a weapon was actually planted in this young man's car. But because he had the kind of reputation that no one would accept, he was carrying a gun, word got out and an investigation was undertaken, and we were getting involved. And I was coming home late one night from my office in Atlanta and was feeling actually tired, but somewhat encouraged because I had a very old car that didn't have a radio that played consistently. But this night my radio was playing, and I was listening to one of my favorite groups that I hadn't heard in a really long time. They were actually doing on the radio a Sly and the Family Stone retrospective. And because they were playing all of these great songs from Sly and the Family Stone, when I got in front of my new apartment, I sat there and I just listened. And I was there maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And that's when an Atlanta SWAT police car pulled up, shined the light on me. The officer started approaching my car. I decided to get out of the car to let him know that this is where I lived. And in the instant that I stood up, the officer pulled his weapon, pointed it at my head, and said, "Move, and I'll blow your head off." And I remember standing there with my hands up, trying to get this officer to calm down, saying to him, "It's all right, it's okay, it's all right, it's okay." And it was terrifying because his hands were shaking. He was clearly afraid. Another officer came out, threw me on the back of the car, and they kept me out there about 20 minutes while the neighbors gathered. And I could hear these people asking the police officers to question me about other crimes in the neighborhood. Pretty humiliating. They did a completely illegal search of my vehicle, wouldn't let me show them that this is where I lived, kept me out there. And at the end of the night, when they determined that they couldn't arrest me for anything, I asked them to apologize, and the officer simply said, you should feel lucky that we're not taking you in, and we'll get you next time," was the thing that the officer said. And it was a really frustrating and maddening experience, not only because of what happened to me, but the burden for me was imagining what would have happened if I had been a young driver at 16 or 17. When I thought about what I would have done when I was 16 or 17 years of age and started driving, if that same thing had happened, if an officer in the middle of the night had pointed a gun at me, I realized...
What do you think you would have done?
Well, I think I would have run, and that terrified me. And that's the reason why I became so anxious to make sure that the young kids of color in my neighborhood who would have to navigate these kinds of experiences were prepared to deal with that. And that sense of that burden, that sense of fear that young people and other kids, just like me but younger, might not safely navigate these encounters is what reinforced just how serious it is that we have this narrative of racial difference in America that continues to create a presumption of guilt and dangerousness for too many people of color. And in many ways, it was a significant event for me because even when I filed a complaint that was 9 pages and typed with legal citations, I couldn't get the police department to acknowledge wrongdoing.
So did that encounter with that police, I mean, that horrible incident that you've just described, did that change the way you pursued your legal career?
It didn't really change it because I was always aware that these dynamics existed. I think it personalized it in a way that was meaningful. And I hadn't really fully encountered the way in which these problems that I take on in individual cases have implications for the entire community. It did make me appreciate how achieving justice for an individual who's been wrongly convicted or unfairly arrested or unfairly sentenced isn't just justice for that person, but it's for all the people in that community. It's for the poor, it's for people of color, it's for people who are disabled, it's for people who are marginalized. And it did get me to appreciate how broad these issues are, even when I'm talking very specifically about a particular client.
Right. Now, you started an organization called the Equal Justice Initiative, which is based in Montgomery, Alabama. What are you trying to do with this organization?
Well, we initially were just trying to provide legal services to people on death row, but as we continued to work on those cases, we saw all these other structural problems. And so now we continue to provide legal aid to people who are condemned to execution. But we also try to talk about the influence of poverty in the criminal justice system. I'm persuaded that we have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And we want to confront that. We want to challenge that because we don't think that wealth should be the determinant that shapes outcomes. We think culpability should. And so we've got projects that are aimed at exposing the ways in which poor people are not adequately served in our criminal justice system. We're challenging conditions of confinement, with the prison population going from 300,000 in 1972 to 2.3 million today. We've got overcrowded prisons where the conditions are horrific. We're also working to help vulnerable populations, the mentally ill, the disabled, and children. One of our big projects is providing legal services to kids who are prosecuted as adults. The United States is the only country in the world that condemns children to die in prison. We've got some 3,000 children in America sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, some as young as 13 and 14 years of age. And so we've taken on those cases. And then our last project area is actually a program on race and poverty. We're really interested in changing the way we talk about race in America, confronting this narrative of racial difference directly.
Now, one of your most memorable cases, which you've written about at some length, it involves a man named Walter McMillian, who was on death row for a crime he did not commit. What was he accused of doing?
He was accused of committing a murder that took place in downtown Monroeville, Alabama. And it was a young woman who was white, who was from an affluent family. And the crime really unsettled the community because it took place right in downtown Monroeville, and the police couldn't make an arrest. There was a lot of disruption, a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear and anger. And 6 months after the crime had taken place, when they had no leads, you could hear people whispering about the competence of the sheriff and the district attorney. And so there was enormous pressure on law enforcement to make an arrest.
And so why was Walter arrested?
Well, this is where it gets very interesting. Walter McMillian was a 45-year-old African-American with no prior crime history. He was not somebody you would suspect of committing a murder. All we could identify that brought Walter to the attention of these folks was that he was having an affair with a young white woman. And we believe that's what provoked some people to target him. And he was eventually arrested and charged with this murder, even though at the time of the crime, he was raising money for his sister's church about 11 miles from the crime scene, surrounded by 30 other African-Americans who could all vouch for his presence at this house 11 miles away. The sheriff was so determined to make an arrest that they just ignored all of that. And then really tried to demonize him. They put him on death row before the case ever went to trial. It's the only case I've ever worked on where the client was actually placed on death row for 15 months before trial. And, of course, that meant that the press would say death row defendant Walter McMillian will be arraigned, or death row defendant Walter McMillian has filed these kinds of pretrial pleadings. And it really painted him in this dangerous way. It was a really, really outrageous case. And, of course, the ultimate irony is that Monroeville, Alabama, is where the famed novelist Harper Lee grew up.
Right. And where she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, which is all about correcting racial injustice.
Exactly. And if you go to that community, you see a community that's deeply preoccupied with that story. All of the streets are named after characters. They have converted the old courthouse into a To Kill a Mockingbird museum. When I first went there, they said, oh, if you're a lawyer, you've got to go over to the courthouse and stand where Gregory Peck stood when he made the film, and you want to experience To Kill a Mockingbird. And there was this disconnect between their romance of that story and what was happening in their community involving an innocent black man being wrongly convicted. And that disconnect for me is a microcosm. It's sort of a metaphor for what's happening in this country where we talk so much about freedom and justice and fairness and equality, and yet we have a criminal justice system that is so compromised by unfairness and inequality and injustice.
But I have to follow up on this case because it is so appalling. I mean, frankly, so unbelievable. I mean, Walter was at a different place. I mean, he had dozens of people who could vouch for him being there. It's mind-boggling that he could be convicted. I guess I just didn't know that this kind of thing still happened in this day and age.
Yeah, it's one of the real problems. I mean, we have a system that I think is still really defined by error. I mean, it's, you know, I think these people were persuaded that they could just make this case against him and that no one would take seriously the African-Americans who were disputing his involvement. They coerced a man to testify falsely against him. And even though his coerced testimony made absolutely no sense, they were able to get a conviction. They moved the case from the county that's 40% African-American and took it to a county that has a very small African-American population, resulting in a nearly all-white jury. And so they convicted him. And there just were all kinds of features to the case that were really hard to make sense of. The judge, whose name is Robert E. Lee Key, overrode the jury's verdict of life and imposed the death penalty. About 23% of the people on our death row got life verdicts from juries that our elected trial judges could override. And the resistance we got in trying to prove Mr. McMillan's innocence, we actually got the tapes where they were coercing this man to testify falsely.
There were actual tapes?
Yes.
That's kind of unbelievable.
It's bizarre. I mean, not only did they have the misjudgment to coerce someone to testify falsely, but they recorded the sessions where they were coercing the witnesses to testify falsely, and they didn't destroy the tapes. So we actually have the tapes. And you had this witness on tape saying, quote, "You want me to frame an innocent man for murder? And I don't feel right about that." But even after we uncovered all of that, there was resistance to acknowledging his innocence. And sadly, these problems still continue.
And you also say that when people first learned that you were starting to work on this case, I mean, to try to get the conviction overturned, didn't the judge actually call you and basically warn you to stay away from this case?
Yes, the judge did call me from Mobile. Judge Robert E. Lee Key did not want an outside lawyer to get involved and basically assured me he was going to make this case as hard and difficult as possible to dissuade me from getting involved. And we had that kind of resistance and hostility throughout this case. There were times when we were investigating the case where we'd be followed. We got bomb threats at our office. There was just a shocking amount of hostility and resistance in the defense of this man who was innocent, you know. And it speaks to the way in which these narratives and the politics of fear and anger can create in a community a tolerance for unfairness and inequality and injustice.
How were you able to get Walter's conviction overturned?
We eventually were able to use these tapes and show that the state had withheld exculpatory evidence that they obviously should have disclosed. The witnesses all recanted. And when we got all of the witnesses to recant, the Alabama Bureau of Investigation did another investigation and agreed with us that Mr. McMillan was innocent and all the charges were dismissed. Not without real cost to Mr. McMillan. He spent 6 years on death row, was there when 8 people were executed, and it haunted him for the rest of his life. He talked about being able to smell the flesh burning when people were electrocuted in the electric chair, and it was obviously devastating to have an entire state trying to kill you day after day, week after week, month after month.
So how unusual is, I mean, this has to be quite unusual, this kind of case, but are there a lot of wrongful convictions?
Oh, it's shocking how frequently this takes place. For every 9 people who have been executed in America, we've now identified 1 innocent person on death row who's been exonerated. There have been over 150 exonerations of innocent people on death row. It's a shocking rate of error. I don't think any of us would tolerate this kind of error in any other area of public life. I know that if in the aviation industry, if for every 9 planes that took off, one crashed and everyone died, nobody would fly. It just would be unacceptable. Yet we have tolerated the kind of error that that we've seen in too many jurisdictions.
How do you explain that?
I think it has to do with our indifference, the sort of these politics of fear and anger. We've persuaded ourselves that some people don't deserve the full protection of the law, don't deserve equal treatment. We've allowed ourselves to get angry and worked up about crime in such a way that we tolerate injustice and inequality. And that's one of the reasons why we've got to think differently about what our system represents. I mean, if you make people afraid and you make people angry, they will accept inhumane treatment. They'll accept gross violations of human rights. You look at the world's greatest atrocities, and behind them, there is a narrative of fear and anger that has legitimated some of these policies. And so for too long, we've had politicians all competing with each other over who can be the toughest on crime, and I think that's got to change for us to have the commitment we need to protect everyone from wrongful conviction.
Are most of these people who have been wrongfully convicted black men?
Yes, they are disproportionately people of color. They're not all people of color, but they are almost all poor. The two common elements are race and poverty. And sadly, this problem continues. I mean, I'm working on a case now of a man who was actually on death row before Walter McMillan in 1985, who is equally innocent and has now been on death row for nearly 30 years. And we've got pretty compelling evidence of his innocence. But getting the state to take seriously their obligation to do justice, it's really hard in this era of mass imprisonment and excessive punishment.
I know you have represented a number of people on death row. What's that like?
You know, I think representing people on death row is, you know, it can be enormously overwhelming and challenging. You see things that you should never have to see. You know, that people are living under the threat of execution by a state, I think is pretty tragic. But I've also been fortunate to see amazing things when we've succeeded. That sense of justice, that sense of triumph is unparalleled. I've also seen a great deal of compassion and humanity and dignity and beauty among people who are trying to show the world, trying to persuade themselves that they are more than their worst mistake. And that's the part that has been inspiring. But what we do to human beings when we condemn them and then we ask other people to kill them is nothing short of tragic, in my judgment. We don't in this country think it's acceptable to rape people who have been convicted of rape. But we just can't imagine what sane human being could be engaged to carry out that kind of behavior. And the same would be true of serious abuse or torture. Yet we think we can kill people who've been convicted of murder. And we think we can do that because we imagine this process that doesn't result in anyone being compromised who's playing a role or anyone being implicated, when the truth is that there is no way to kill a healthy human being that doesn't demean us, that doesn't diminish us. And I've seen
that. So you're saying it's not just about sort of taking away the life of this person, even if guilty, but you're saying it diminishes the rest of us, too.
I think it does. I mean, I am persuaded that we're all more than the worst thing we've ever done. I think even for the guilty, I think if someone tells a lie, they're not just a liar. If somebody takes something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. I think even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. The problem with the death penalty is that it kills more than the crime. It kills the other things that every human being is. And in that respect, it is disproportionate with basic humanity, with what dignity requires. I understand the need to punish, and we've got to punish, but I don't think we need the death penalty. The other issue for me is that I don't believe that the death penalty is really, we can't establish it legitimately by asking, do people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed? My view is that the real question is, do we deserve to kill? And when you have a system that is so compromised by mistake and error, compromised by bias against people of color and a history of racial inequality, compromised by the inability to provide equal services to the poor, then I don't think we should be engaged in a punishment that requires perfection when we have a far from perfect system.
You have also represented kids, I mean children as young as 13, who were, in some cases, sentenced to life in prison without parole. And you tell a story about one boy, I think he was 14 at the time, named Charlie. What was he in jail for?
Yeah, that was one of my early cases, a really tragic case of a child who was living in a house where his mother was repeatedly the target of a lot of domestic violence. And this boy's mother had a boyfriend that would start drinking and just become violent. And one day the man had been drinking, came home, came into the kitchen, walked up to the boy's mother, punched her in the face, knocked her unconscious. And this little boy was trying to get his mom to wake up. And after 10 minutes of trying to revive his mom, she was covered with blood, and the little boy thought his mom was dead. And the man had gone into a bedroom and fallen asleep, so the little boy got up, walked into the bedroom, opened a dresser drawer, pulled out a handgun, and then walked over to where the man was sleeping. The man stood was snoring, and when the man stopped snoring, the little boy tragically pulled the trigger, shot the man in the head, and he died instantly. Child was about 5 feet tall. He was under 100 pounds. He was only 14. And he was the kind of kid who might have been tried as an adult, but for the fact that the man that he shot and killed, his mother's boyfriend, he was a deputy sheriff. And because of his status, the prosecutor insisted that this child be prosecuted as an adult and was immediately placed in the adult jail. And that's where I'd met him for the first time after he'd been there for 3 days. And it was heartbreaking because I couldn't get this child to say a word. He just kept staring at the wall. And eventually I got up and I walked around the table and pulled my chair close to him and said, look, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. You got to talk to me. He wouldn't say a word. And there was a point at which I just started leaning on him because I couldn't figure out what else to do. And when I did that, this little boy leaned back. And when he leaned back, I put my arm around him and said, come on, talk to me. And this child began to cry. And through his tears, he began talking to me, not about what happened with the man, not about what happened with his mom. But he started talking about what had happened at the jail. And he told me on the first night he'd been hurt by several men. He told me on the next night he'd been raped by several people. He told me on the night before I'd gotten there, so many people had hurt him, he couldn't remember how many there had been. And I held this little boy while he cried hysterically, you know, for almost an hour. And when I left that jail, I couldn't help but think, who is responsible for this? And I realized we are. We've allowed our society to put children in these imperiled places behind a narrative that's false and incomplete, behind our anger and fear. All children are children, but our laws don't reflect that. We try to treat children as adults when they're not. And, it set me on a path that has resulted in us challenging in a pretty aggressive way the prosecution of children as adults. We've been to the Supreme Court a couple of times and won some cases that have created some relief for kids prosecuted as adults, but there's still a lot more work to be done.
Is there anything you could do to help this boy, Charlie?
We got him out of that jail immediately, and I write in the book about a wonderful family that ultimately got involved with him, and I'm happy to report he's doing really well. We were able to get him out after a relatively short period of time. And he's doing really well, but obviously that's a lifelong burden to have to bear. And even as we speak, there are some 10,000 children in the United States in adult jails or prisons. There are about 28 states that still allow kids 17 and younger to be placed in adult jails or prisons where they have no sight or sound separation from adults. And they're about 8 times more likely to be the victims of sexual assault and about 11 times more likely to attempt suicide.
Are these kinds of cases happening all around the country, or do they tend to happen in particular parts of the country?
No, interestingly, they happen all over the country. I mean, obviously, there are the states actually with the highest number of children prosecuted as adults and sentenced to die in prison are actually Pennsylvania and Michigan. There's also Louisiana. There are also states all over the country. But this is a national problem. There are some issues that we work on that are particularly egregious in the South, But over-incarceration, excessive punishment, mistreatment of vulnerable populations, you can find that in virtually every state in this country.
You know, hearing a story like the one that you just told about Charlie, I mean, it is just heartbreaking. How do you deal with that? I mean, how do you go on yourself?
Yeah. Well, I do think you have to prepare yourself for, some proximity to suffering, to really raw pain. But I'm persuaded that's what gives you power and insight. I don't think we're going to come up with good solutions to these problems until we get close enough to see all the nuances and all of the details that are underneath the issues that, you know, we're talking about. And you have to prepare yourself for that.
How do you prepare yourself?
Well, I think it's just in recognizing that this is what justice requires. For me, justice is a constant struggle. And I can't let my discomfort dissuade me from dealing with someone else's discomfort and pain, which is greater than my own. You know, I think I take an historical perspective. I live and work in Montgomery, Alabama. There are times when I feel like, man, this has been a really difficult day. This has been a draining day. It's been an emotional day or a challenging day. But I think about where I am in this line of history. My great-grandfather was enslaved in Bowling Green, Virginia. My grandmother grew up during the time of terrorism and lynching. My parents were subjected to Jim Crow and segregation their whole lives. All of them faced greater challenges, greater threats, with fewer resources than I face. And that's what orients me. As difficult as my days have sometimes been, I've never had to say, my head is bloodied but not bowed, like the people who were working in Montgomery 50 years ago.
So that's so interesting. I mean, so what you're, I mean, it's like you bring this whole weight of history into your work, and it informs how you've chosen to live your life.
It really does. And, you know, that history is very close for me. It shaped me. I mean, I started my education in a colored school. And so I saw what the interventions of other people could do. I mean, lawyers came into our community and opened up the public schools, which changed the trajectory of my life. And so I do feel that opportunity that comes when you can make a difference. And I know how transformative it can be for people. And I want to share whatever I can do to create more opportunities for coming generations.
So there, it seems like, I mean, there's so many issues at play here. One is, I mean, the obvious injustice in the criminal courts. I mean, as you've described, some of these cases, for instance, of wrongful conviction or just sort of horrible treatment of people. There's also just the kind of conversation that it seems like we need to have about race and justice in this country. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what we can do about that, how we can talk about this.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I do think we've practiced silence about these issues for too long. I mean, many countries that have tried to recover from gross violations of human rights have recognized that there has to be truth and reconciliation. You can't ignore what's happened. We haven't done that. We never in this country talked about slavery and the distortions created by the narrative of racial difference that slavery represented. For me, the great evil of slavery was not involuntary servitude. It was this ideology of white supremacy that we created to legitimate slavery.
And it seems like we have talked about slavery, though. I mean, it's in all of our history books, but you're saying we haven't had the real conversation we need to have about it?
Yes, and I don't think actually what's in our history books represents the true evil of slavery. I mean, if you live in my part of the country, I'm sitting here in Montgomery, Alabama, where 2 years ago there were 59 monuments and markers to the mid-19th century. We celebrate the Confederacy in this region of the country. In this state, Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. A Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. It's not Martin Luther King Day. It's Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. And we've romanticized the mid-19th century, and we've glorified it, and we haven't said a word about slavery. If you came here 2 years ago, you wouldn't find a word about it. And so I don't think we've actually confronted the legacy of that narrative. In my view, slavery didn't end in 1865. It evolved. And that's not something we've talked about, because we were compromised by this difference, this narrative, this ideology, this racial hierarchy for decades. And that's why we then had lynching, and that's why we had convict leasing. That's how we got to segregation and the need for a civil rights movement. And we still haven't talked about the narrative of racial difference. We've never had truth and reconciliation. And because of that, I think we are still compromised by our failure to deal honestly with this issue. If you go to Germany, you are forced to deal with the legacy of the Holocaust. There are monuments and markers everywhere about the families that were abducted.
Excuse me, I need to jump in. Your line is breaking up for some reason. I don't know what's happened there. So
okay.
Okay. There. Maybe you were just getting very close to the phone. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I'm still talking right into the mic, so hopefully I'm good there.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No problem. If you go to Germany, you are forced to confront the legacy of the Holocaust. There are markers and monuments at all of the spaces where families were abducted. You're encouraged to go to the concentration camps and reflect soberly on the history of the Holocaust. In this country, we do the opposite. We've got a project to put up markers and monuments at lynching sites all over the country. We just put out a report about lynching because we've never dealt with that part of our history. We don't have the recognition of the way in which the slave trade devastated communities of color. Even the exiles that terrorism created in the South that fled to Cleveland, Chicago, and Detroit, we don't understand that history very well. So I do think we've got a lot of work in our country to do. There's a lot of work to do in our country to confront this history and this legacy more soberly and more effectively.
Can you play that out for me a little bit? I mean, what would you want us to do? I mean, how should we be dealing with this history?
Well, we're starting in Montgomery. So I mentioned how there were all of these monuments and markers to the Confederacy and nothing about slavery. We erected three markers to the slave trade, and we put them in public spaces with great resistance. The Alabama Historical Association didn't want us to do it. They said it would be too controversial. But I think that's a healthy step forward. I want to mark the spaces where lynchings took place. I want to mark the spaces where people suffered from segregation. I think we ought to create enough truth about our history that we begin to think and talk about what reconciliation requires. And this isn't just an issue for people of color. You know, we've got a generation of people in this country who were taught that they're better than other people because of their skin color. And that's a kind of abuse, in my judgment. And if we're not doing things to correct that, we're going to see the implicit bias that plays out day in and day out. So if you go to other countries, there is an active dialogue manifesting itself in hundreds of ways. And I'd like to see that happen in this country. I'd like to see police departments acknowledge their past and present injustices, their racial profiling, and signaling that they're going to start a new day. I'd like school systems to do the same. I'd like public institutions to do the same. I'd like us to retreat from this false narrative of how wonderful it was in the good old days, how glorious life was in the mid-19th century, which you see all over the South. I think there's a lot of work that can and should be done. You know, just earlier in March, thousands of people came to Selma to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March. The president came. President Bush was there. Everybody was there. And standing in the background was the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is named after a grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. And the question is, why do we want the bridge that welcomes people into Selma, Alabama, to be named after a wizard of the Ku Klux Klan? Why do we want that? We're silent about that. And I think that silence has to change, because what we have now is a society where people have learned to mimic the behaviors of people who are not racially biased, but we actually haven't tried to deal with eliminating racial bias and inequality.
Well, you have told us quite a story. Thank you so much for coming in to talk with us.
Happy to be with you.